Good night, good night. No, that, we're just... All right. I'll just have to say I'm can you hear me okay, first of all? I'm just a wee bit nervous here. I think maybe I have to say the Serenity Prayer one more time, just so I hear it. And this time, because when I looked at the theme for my talk, it didn't say, I am the message. It said, we are the message. So anyway, tonight the focus is on us, all of us. And I hope I have everything out here. So if you would join me, we'll say the Serenity Prayer with we, the plural. Okay. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. Wow. Anyway, you know, I heard so many speakers this weekend that my brain was just going all around in circles, and I kind of forgot what I was planning to talk about tonight. So this is from my higher power to you. When I talk about we are the message, it just reminds me that probably my most glaring character defect was self-sufficiency. And I used to kid around and I'd say, you know, God can do it better, but I can do it faster. However, that always meant I had to do it over again. Anyway, I'll try to get back on track. The other day in Voices of Recovery, it was April 11th, April 12th, and it said, practicing the principle of faith today means that we will no longer go through life acting however we feel like acting at any given moment. Instead, we will look to our higher power for guidance and strength as we face each decision. That's from the 12 and 12, page 104. I used to sit on the fence, afraid of making decisions. What if I made the wrong decision? Faith in God has taught me that decisions need not scare me. As I work step 3, I try to find God's will for me for each day. If I honestly seek his will, I believe I am practicing step 3. I turn to God for guidance and wait for the intuitive knowledge that he provides. I've come to believe there are no mistakes or wrong decisions, only different lessons. Whichever way I go, I learn something. I trust God to provide me with those lessons and look forward to learning and growing. And I always write on the meditations in the morning, and this was my response. There are no mistakes in life or wrong decisions, only different lessons. I can attest to that because when I was young, I made a lot of poor choices. Yet God helped me turn my life around when I began to take care of myself by working the Al-Anon and OA programs. There were many blessings as a result of my hard learning lessons. So that's, you know, just a reminder that I don't have to be a martyr. I don't have to live in the poor decisions. But that's not the way I started out. And I was the second oldest of 7 kids, and I thought we had a very normal home life, and I think in a lot of respects we did. My dad was hardworking. My mother was a wonderful mother, very loving and caring, and, I mean, she'd probably give her life for any one of us. But somewhere along the line, my dad became this raging man, especially at the dinner table. And I could never understand what he was so mad about. I mean, the potatoes were too wet, or, you know, the steak was too tough, or, you know, it was always complaining about something or complaining about what we kids did. And the only way that I could get rid of all that discomfort was to eat more. So at about the age of 5, I learned how to use food like a drug, just like one of our previous speakers had talked about that. And I always say, well, candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker. And so I just kind of blocked out anything that was uncomfortable to me. And I had very many lapses in, I always call it blackout things, in my life, things that I didn't remember and things that didn't surface until many, many years in program. And I had this deep resentment toward my dad, and I couldn't quite figure out why was I so angry with him. And, you know, I had been in program at least 10 years and was really struggling with trying to have any good thoughts about my dad. And I went on a retreat in Green Bay, I believe it was, that there was this retreat, and it was called the Healing Weekend. And they told us about how to forgive somebody that you had difficulty forgiving. And they said, you take the person you resent and picture them as a 4-year-old. And then after you think about that 4-year-old, then you shrink them down, you put them in your hand, and then you put them in your heart. And so I did that with my dad, and I started thinking about his life. And he was the second oldest of 10 children and had to quit school in 4th grade and go to work for a farmer delivering milk or something, I think. But and then later on, my grandmother died, and she was 57 years old when she died. Anyway, my dad and mother bought the house from the estate with the stipulation that Grandpa could live with us, you know, as long as he did. And I loved my grandpa. He was a funny guy. He'd really play with us kids and stuff. I didn't realize that he was the town drunk. And my mom would always say, like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, run over to Joe Eberle's bowling alley, which was just down the street from us, and tell Grandpa he better get home before Dad gets home from work. So he was there drinking and playing cards with his cronies. But when I came in the back door, then he said, oh, here's Judy, he said, and we'll put her up on the bar, and then they'd put money in the jukebox, and I'd sing for him, you know, pistol pack and mama, lay that pistol down. You know. So anyway, he was fun, and my dad was just so angry. And then I realized, you know, many, many years later, that here he probably blamed his dad for his mother's early death, and then he gets stuck with him living in our house on top of it. So it made sense at that point that that's why he was so mad. He, you know, and they didn't have programs in those days to learn how to deal with that kind of stuff. Anyway, fast forward. I'm kind of going backwards here. So I was really heavy in grade school, and I was very jealous of... We had about 4 little gals in my class, blonde hair, blonde curly hair, blue eyes, you know, cute little patent leather shoes and, you know, white socks with lace on them. And here I come, you know, stick straight hair, freckles, couldn't see. And also was the biggest one. And, you know, the way people would introduce me, oh, here's Judy. She's such a nice big girl. And that word big just went, So anyway, that was my picture of myself. So I had this low self-esteem around my appearance, and but I was pretty smart in school, so I just leaned on, you know, being the smartest one in the class and all that stuff. So I would make up for the deficiencies by pushing something else. But I put on so much weight in, at puberty, and I was in seventh or eighth grade, and I don't know what the principal of the school was a nun, and my mother was pregnant again, and she took some of her house dresses and cut them down so they'd fit me, because nothing fit. And she and I, "Oh, well, Judy, I see you got your mother's dress on," or something like that, you know. So she made these remarks. Anyway, going into high school, I didn't want to be fat. And I stopped eating. Like that summer, I probably did just a total restriction. But I was probably 14 years old when I started drinking. And I'd always have blackouts. When I would drink, I'd blackout. And then the next morning, I wouldn't know where I had been, who I'd been with, when I got home. And my parents were so busy, they didn't really even realize, you know, that I was doing so badly. In this day and age, they probably would have put me in a rehab place. But anyway, fast forward a little more, and I went off to college, and very, very competitive, and always leaning on the people around me. I was a people pleaser, and like a chameleon, and I'd like to blend into whatever anybody else was doing. So, now I've lost my train of thought. My roommate got engaged. Well, I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Then she doesn't have to come back to school. Maybe I should get engaged. Of course, I have been just dumped by my last boyfriend, you know. So I went home from college for Easter weekend, and I went up to the Minor Bar in Campbellsport, if anybody knows where that is. And there was this guy sitting at the bar, and I thought, he looks pretty nice. So I went over and talked to him, and he wound up taking me home. And 5 months later, we got married, you know. So talk about bad decisions. So I didn't know that he had been discharged from the Army on a medical discharge. He was drinking the night I met him, but then he told me that he wasn't drinking anymore. He had made a pledge at church or something. But anyway, I had such a skewed image of what love was all about and what relationships were all about. I had no clue what love is. You know, to me it was being needed. So his mother died when he was 12 years old, so he really needed a mother. But instead he got me. And shortly into the marriage, his drinking really escalated a lot, and I was still drinking too, and I just said, one of us has to know what's going on, you know. So I quit drinking, went right back to my old buddy food. Like I said, candy's dandy, but liquor's quicker, so I had to eat more to bury the feelings. And that brought us into a total of 18-year, just a disastrous marriage. And when I was reading about these discipline, you know, the lessons that we learned from the Hard Knocks, and I thought, gee, I wonder how my life would have been different if I had made a different decision. And then I thought, yeah, but, you know, we have four beautiful daughters, and, you know, I wouldn't change a lot of that. And I always look for these guys that were diamonds in the rough. You know, I thought, I see these good points. Like, he was a poet, and artist and, you know, could talk a good talk and everything. So that's what attracted me. And I thought, well, if I just get my hands on him and polish him up a little bit, he'll be a really good guy. Anyway, fast forward again, you know, so this continued. Oh, I have to tell you that I grew up in a very strict religious home. The only thing was I never got the core of the what they were teaching us. Just a lot of rites and rituals, and there were so many externals that I didn't know the core, and I certainly didn't know God, and I think I had God and church confused. But anyway, nobody in our family had ever gotten divorced. Besides, I wasn't going to give up that easy. I figured that I hung in there, I'm going to do it. And, you know, the first 10 years of marriage was rough. But then the last 8 years, out of those 8 years, we probably were together a total of about two. Because in and out of the hospitals, losing a job, it was just one crisis after another. And I just, that's how I live, from one crisis to another, and using food to bury all those feelings. And then, of course, I always had these people saying, oh, you're doing such a good job, you're such a nice person, you know, it's too bad you have such a rotten husband, you know. So anyway, it had gotten to the point that I was really suicidal. I just couldn't see any reason for living, and I'm in my 30s. I had already gone to Al-Anon, but that was sort of like the auxiliary, and after the meetings, we would serve the coffee and the sweets. So those ladies, you know, they didn't really get the program. But in 1974, there were two ladies that had come to or started a new group, and I started going there, and they had a very total different approach. And they didn't want to hear about my problems. They didn't want to hear about my husband. They didn't want to hear about my kids or anything else. Just they wanted to hear about me and what made me tick. And they kept saying, we love you and God loves you. And then I was working with one of them as a sponsor, and we were going through the steps. And it came to doing the fourth step, and they were encouraging me to do this. And I hemmed and hawed around about, you know, I didn't have the time and blah, blah, blah. So somebody bought me a ticket to a retreat. And I thought, well, that's a good opportunity. I'll do the fourth step, and then I'll give it to the retreat master. And a lot of you, I apologize, have heard this story so many times, but it's such a core part of my recovery. I went and gave him my fourth step, and instead of just saying, oh, it'll get better, you can do it, and this and that, instead he looked at me and said, lady, ever cross your mind that maybe you're setting yourself up above God? It was like a bolt of lightning, you know. And it was just like it just did something. Anyway, I went out into the chapel, and there was music playing in the background, but it was a song with the words of Psalm 139 that said, where can I run from your love? If I climb to the heavens, you are there. If I fly to the sunrise or sail beyond the seas, still I'll find you there. And all of a sudden, I just felt like somebody had their arms around me. And I looked back, but there was nobody there. But I knew then that I had experienced a spiritual experience. And I never again questioned that there was a God who loved me and who could forgive me. And I could see the arrogance and the pride that, you know, put me in that position. So the next day I made up my mind, okay, I'm going to give God my will and my life, and I'm going to go back to Weight Watchers. So I gave them my will and my life, but not my food. I mean, isn't that typical? I could handle that, right? And four months later, so this was right around Christmas, so this was in April. Again, I talked about the blackout drinking. Well, I came home from work early on that Friday before Easter, and we were going to color Easter eggs. And I thought, oh, you've been so good, you know, just one jelly bean won't hurt you. Okay. That one jelly bean turned into a weekend blackout. And, oh, I think it was around Christmas this year. No, I've been in program almost 49 years. My girls were home. And a couple of them live in upper Michigan, and, you know, one lives up north. And I asked, I said, you know, I had this blackout, you know, back in 75, but I really don't know what I did that whole weekend. And then my second daughter started telling me of their experience where they didn't have school, so my husband took the two younger ones were at my mother's, and he took them out in the Kettle Moraine because they used to do a lot of hiking and stuff. And Dan, okay, we'll be all right. He had been on and abuse because he was trying very hard not to drink. And that particular day, I guess he chose to drink anyway. And he passed out. And the girls walked to a farmer's house and asked to use the telephone to call, you know, the ambulance. And so, you know, that's what happened. And I just found that out now. That's how deeply that blackout was, so deep that I had no clue what I had done that weekend. And I could never quite figure out how could I get to that desperate level by filling myself with sugar that I'd have this blackout. So it was not only the physical blackout, but I think the emotional blackout along with it. Anyway, that was a real turning point for me also, because as she was telling me this, I had a couple of flashbacks of being at the hospital, and my husband was there with, you know, all kinds of tubes and everything going in and out of them. And the man who ran the halfway house was there. And I had been working, you know, with the AA community, you know, different activities, etc. And he came over to me and he just said, Judy, there is absolutely nothing you can do for him. You have to start taking care of yourself. And that is what brought me to my knees on Monday morning, along with the blackout, that I just said, God help me, you have to send me somebody because I can't do this myself. Those are the words that I seldom said, was I can't do this myself, because like I said, my chief character defect was self-sufficiency. And I remembered that a year before, my cousin had stopped at the house. And in response to the New Berlin, they thought 50-ish years. Well, it turns out that that starter kit had been sent by Dolores W. from the New Berlin meeting. So it must have been at least 1974 that they started. So, so I pulled this starter kit down, and I looked it over, and I put an article together, took it to the newspaper office. I called the hospital, and they said we could have a meeting room on Wednesday nights. And so the article was in the newspaper, and 54 people showed up at the hospital to find all about this OA, what it is. So that was my start in OA. And of course, we had very little in the way of literature. Nancy and I were talking earlier that what did we have? Three food plans, gray sheet, blue sheet, orange sheet. We had a couple pamphlets. One was If God Spoke to OA, and the other one was Before You Take That First Compulsive Bite. And then we had some Hazelton literature that was approved. But anyway, I was trying to run these meetings by the seat of my pants because, you know, yeah, I had been in Al-Anon for 8 years, but I didn't really learn very much in Al-Anon. And I don't know, about a month in, one of the ladies that was coming said, you know, they have intergroup meetings in Milwaukee. You know, maybe we should go and see what everybody else is doing. And then we found out all of the traditions we were breaking. But we really got involved. And then some of us would drive down to Greendale on the south side of Milwaukee on Sunday nights. They had a very strong meeting going. It was a lot of fun. And then at the end of the meeting, everybody go out to and have dinner on Sunday night. And it was a late night and a long night, but I learned so much from those speakers and stuff. And that's why I love conventions and workshops and stuff, because I learned more from listening to speakers help me to discover what I felt, what I had blocked out, where I was really coming from. And, you know, we learn as we go. And I learned more by the mistakes I made than anything else. I had a relapse 10 years into program when a lot of these memories were starting to surface. And I started going to 1st step. It was an outpatient program. And that helped me a lot. And I got right back on program. I didn't gain any weight or anything. Oh, I had lost like 100 pounds in the first year because I came in at about 260. And but then, you know, when we stop using food, we have to catch up to where we started using it. And, you know, so I had to become a 5-year-old and go through that, and then I had to become a teenager, and there's nothing uglier than a 40-year-old teenager. So my girls were waiting up for me to come home at night. You know, that wasn't too pretty. But there was a lot of stuff. And I could switch to any addiction. I could go from, you know, from booze to food to relationships to sex to whatever. I never became a gambler because I'm never lucky. But I know I mentioned it to the leader of our first step group, and he said, you know, I think the only thing I've never been addicted to is gambling. And he says, what do you mean you're gambling with your life every day? And how true that was, that I was really gambling with my most precious possession, which was my life. So that helped me a lot. And then I had my last relapse I've been married 3 times. The third is a charm. And but after being married, you know, into the first year of our marriage, I started putting OA on the back burner. I wasn't doing as much, going to as many meetings. I wasn't doing service. And I fell into a very deep depression, and not depression, relapse, serious relapse. And every day I would try to get abstinent, and I was not having any luck. And I know it was April 27th at the Sunday night meeting, they always celebrated birthdays. And I was too ashamed to raise my hand. And I, on the way home, I was crying. And I said, God help me, you have to send me somebody. And the next day, I had a knock on the door, and it's a friend of mine from the South Side, and she said, they're starting a Howl meeting on the South Side tomorrow night. Would you like to come with me? So God sent me somebody. And then I realized, you know, they talked about rigorous honesty and self-discipline, and I knew that self-discipline was the thing that was lacking in my program. And I got a sponsor the first night. She said, close your mouth and open your ears. And then we started going through the steps as if I had never heard of them before. And I worked through, you know, all the questions, all the steps, and I've been abstinent ever since. Every day has been a commitment to abstinence, and I know that this 24 hours is the only time that I have, and I have to start it out with my third step prayer, with my reading and meditation and writing, and write out my food plan, call my sponsor, and then I have a 10th step sponsor. I call her my accountability sponsor, and I text her a 10th step gratitude list, and I've been doing that consistently, going to about 6 meetings a week, and I'm, you know, doing service and whatever I can. And I'm alone now with a big old fat kid. But my husband died like 7 years ago. And I always wondered how I would get along just taking care of me and not taking care of everybody else. And it has been the best thing for me to just know that I can be okay in my own skin. I don't need validation from anybody else. I don't need somebody to lean on, and I don't have to rescue anybody. I just have to take care of myself. With that, I pass. I'm ready to roll here. Why don't we get... let's just say the Serenity Prayer one more time. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. Well, I got a bunch of cards here. Some of them aren't questions, though, so that's kind of nice. One says, I love you, Judy. That was nice. And somebody else wanted me to sing Pistol Pack and Mama. Okay. Okay. This one is kind of cute. What would you say to your 4-year-old self as God was hugging her in your pocket, in her pocket? You know, just that, you're perfect. You're perfect, just the way I made you. You know, so I have work for you to do. This is another one. How has your addiction affected your daughters? How about now that they are adults? That's a very good question, because they had a much more chaotic beginning than I ever had. But they learned pretty early on about addiction. And we were in family counseling when they were... I would say the youngest one was 10 and the oldest one was 16, that we were going to family counseling. So, and then they went to Alateen and different things. So they've gotten, but 2 of them are alcoholics recovering, and the other 2 may have an eating disorder, but they're kind of working on it. None of them want anything to do with 12-step programs. I wonder why. and my granddaughter is a recovering alcoholic, and we have a wonderful relationship, and, you know, go to meetings together and everything. So we've become closely connected. I have a wonderful relationship with my girls. The youngest one, we had a really rough time when in making the amends. She wanted to talk to me because she's one of them that's alcoholic, and she just unloaded on me, you know, just everything under the sun. And one of the things she said is, you used to stick me in a closet and just let me scream and scream and scream. And I said, I never did that. And then I remembered we were living in a farmhouse, and they had, you know, about the size of like a walk-in closet, but it was adjacent to our bedroom, and I had her crib in there. So, I mean, that's what she remembered. But anyway, and then I made amends to her, and we have a good relationship. How do you stay in the moment? Pause. Put aside unsettling situations and exhale. Because when I get anxious, I stop breathing. I hold my breath. I can remember walking to school and holding my breath all the way from the house all the way to the school because it was cold out and it hurt my lungs. So I have to remember to breathe. So, and then I ask myself questions, you know, like if I get disturbed about something, how important is it anyway, you know? And I don't engage in arguments, and, you know, I'd rather be happy than right. This one says, my fear is switching addictions. Are you in other 12-step programs? I have gone to Al-Anon periodically, but OA is my first addiction, and it has really, because I'm focusing on me, and I'm very aware of, you know, trying to be detached and watch for, even now, you know, with sponsees and stuff, I have to be kind of careful because I often attract some very needy people, and I could really get sucked into, you know, their problems rather than just referring them to program. I quote a lot of program to them. But the awareness of how easily I can get off on a tangent, you know, into other things like shopping and all those things. But, you know, once I really had this really close dependence on my higher power, it seemed like I didn't need to go to other things to distract me because I was able to accept life on life's terms and to recognize that whatever the situation is, there's something I can learn from it. So instead of looking at the crisis and the difficult times as problems, I've looked at them as blessings that, you know, and then just ask myself, what can I learn from this? You know, what's the message I'm supposed to get here? And then doing a 10th step, of course, really seals the deal because then I don't let anything pile up on me. This is about, do you talk about the solution with your daughters? Yes, I do. How did I surrender my food? Well, like I said, that blackout just scared the heck out of me. And, but I didn't learn as much from that as I did from that last relapse when I was trying so hard every single day to get back on track. And it wasn't until I surrendered my self-will and just said, I will follow my sponsor's directions. And I will ask my higher power for the right thought or inspiration of what the next thing I should be doing is. And, you know, it always seems to come about. And the other thing, if I'm making a decision, I don't hem and haw around. I make a decision based on what I feel is right. And then I ask God, if this isn't the right decision, put up some yellow flashing lights, red lights. And that's what I did when I remarried in 1991. I was scared to death of getting into another relationship. And we had a very strong spiritual life together. And so when we decided that we were going to get married, we prayed together and said, this is what we would like to do. If there's any reason we shouldn't be doing it, put up the yellow lights, the red lights, so that we know. And it was just like everything just fell into place, just one thing after another, and there really weren't any. And our marriage was a very blessed marriage. Even though I went into relapse, that was me. That was me, because I thought, oh, now my life is the way I want it to be. Now I don't need all this help. But, you know, there's my self-sufficiency again. And some of the things I do to take care of myself, I take a nap every day. I do a lot of walking. I take my cat for a walk. What else do we do? I go to about 6 meetings a week, and I go to a couple of, you know, other church groups, and I have, you know, lots of sponsees. Time's up with all of them? Okay. Any other hints on how not to live on self-will and run the show ourselves? Well, I had to learn the hard way, you know, and I always think that maybe by me sharing some of my lessons, that maybe somebody else will hear something that'll ring true to them, and they'll find their way to. All of the answers are inside each and every one of us. And I won't go there. What do you do to keep your abstinence now you are off your latest relapse? Well, like I said, I went to daily commitment that if I do tomorrow what I'm doing today, I will be abstinent when tomorrow comes around. You know, so I only look at this 24 hours. And a thing that has helped me, a nutritionist, because I'm 86 years old, and you know, your skin gets saggy, and you know, but my doctor says I'm in very good health, and couldn't believe, you know, how old I was, and you know, with my blood pressure, my blood sugar, everything, you know, I have no ailments, I have nothing, and I feel so very blessed. But I told him it was due to working this Overeaters Anonymous program every day and taking care of myself, because today I know that if I don't take care of myself, no one else will. And above that, I'm no good to anybody else either. Most important thing you would tell a newcomer, I guess, keep coming back. You know, I was a quick starter and a quick finisher. And but OA is something that I have never stopped. Even in relapse, I still continue to go to at least one meeting a week. And even when we went on a cruise or something, I'd always go to the Bill W. meetings and stuff like that. So I always made sure that I had at least one a week. But I always say 7 days without a meeting makes 1 week, W-E-A-K. So meetings are the most important thing. And, you know, get a sponsor. Really follow the disciplines of the program and then just take it one day at a time. That's what I tell newcomers, you know, and keep coming back. And I offer people, you know, like that first 12 days and stuff like that. How do I connect to HP during times of sorrow? I always try to find something to be grateful for. And as one of the people in program used to say, you can't be hateful and grateful at the same time. And I really learned that if God brings me to it, he will bring me through it. And I reach out to my OA friends. When my husband died, very suddenly, my OA family and my real family, but they just carried me. And you know, the poem about the footprints in the sand, those were the times when my higher power was carrying me, and my footprints weren't there. They were my higher power's footprints. And there were many times that he was carrying me. So, you know, this is a long journey. It's a journey in life. And I got this 24 hours, and I can make the best of it, or I can whine and complain and tell everybody how rough I have it and stuff like that. You know, I am truly, truly blessed. And I feel that no matter what's going on, that this is my journey and I'm going to live it. So there were a couple other things in here, but they weren't. Oh, this is kind of cool. You went from being very dependent to a healthy independence and now interdependence. And that's true. I was, you know, self-sufficient. And then that independence, you know, that can be a trap to think that you're so independent that you don't need anybody. But I do need people. I need people, and I need all of you people, because it is a we program. You know, there aren't any I's in the 12 steps. It's we. And interdependent, yes, because I know today that my higher power is providing the power, and I'm the hands and feet going through the emotions. So that's all we have here. Is that enough time? I think I overdone it.